This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Feminism in your ears. It's another broad podcast on Joy 94.9. Keep listening. Hashtag feminism. Hashtag podcast. Hashtag broad. On Joy 94.9.
This podcast is presented to you by Broad on Joy 94.9 at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival. Broad presents Queer, Transgender and Feminist Writing.
Hi everybody, welcome to our final session for today in this room. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we gather, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, pay our respects to their elders past and present and to any other elders who are here today. My name is Veronica Sullivan and I'm a member of the steering committee for the FWF, and I'm just going to introduce the panel and then kind of get out of the way and let them carry on with this fabulous conversation. So first to my nearest to me is Amy Middleton. Amy is a Melbourne-based journalist, writer, and founding editor of Archer magazine, an award-winning publication about sex, gender, and identity. She has written and edited for many publications, including The Bulletin, Rolling Stone, The Guardian, The Lifted Brow, The Big Issue, and others. She produces a women's current affairs radio show on 3CR and was named among Gay News Network's Top 25 People to Watch in 2015 and Melbourne Writers Festival's 30 Under 30 in the same year. Please welcome Amy. Next along on our panel is Alison Evans. Alison is the author of We Go Forward and the forthcoming Iva, co-editor of Concrete Queers, a zine maker and lover of bad movies. Their work has been published in various Australian and international magazines, literary journals and zines. Please welcome Alison. And at the end of the stage, we have Alina Muhammad Ali. Alina is a Pakistani-Australian queer Muslim woman who spent many years as a community legal centre lawyer before retraining as a primary school teacher. She founded the Queer Muslims in Australia Yahoo Group and had a long tenure on the Australian GLBTIQ Multicultural Council, Inc. She's currently writing a cookbook on modern Australian cuisine with a Pakistani twist. Please welcome Alina. And I'm now going to hand right over to Amy to continue with the panel.
Thanks, Ronnie. Hi, everybody. Hope everyone's had a good day. I've been here from about 2 onwards, so if we repeat any content, apologies. There's a good chance we probably won't. Thanks for that introduction. I'd also like to acknowledge the traditional landowners of the land on which we meet, pay respects to their elders past and present. I guess I want to start by saying that if you were new to feminist thinking, which I kind of think maybe I still am, I'm definitely learning more every day and getting a more feminist lens every day, which is frightening and makes me pretty mad most of the time. If you were new to feminist thinking, and perhaps if you were new to queer politics or queer communities, you might think that the two have quite a friendly history. But actually, it's not quite that simple. I guess I haven't really studied much academically about feminist history or queer history, but I do spend a lot of time in the community talking to individuals, particularly through my work with Archer magazine, which essentially collects the attitudes of people who are left out of mainstream media on topics around sex and gender. And feminism and queer politics kind of have a bit of a, I guess, interesting history and relationship. And I'd like to go into that today. I guess when we do talk about that tricky relationship, it's important to point out that there are a million different kinds of feminism. And I get the sense from being here for the last couple of hours that the brand of feminism that dominates in this room is a pretty friendly one. This festival has said that it's against hate speech and aggression, I think the wording is, which I think is a pretty good place to start any debate, and I'm certainly non-confrontational in my approach to everything, pretty scared of fighting generally. But that said, I think it's important to look at the history of both those movements and where they've intersected and where possibly they haven't intersected all that smoothly. And before I ask my first question, I also want to mention that whatever we talk about, certainly on my behalf, is my own experience, despite our diverse identities, which generally is the panel that we're on. Agreed? I'm always on the diversity panel. We don't speak for all queer people, all trans people, all same-sex attracted folk, all lesbians, all women, all Muslim people, all people with freshly shaved heads, or any other group. We just speak from our own individual experience, and that's always up for discussion. So, to hand over to you two, as I mentioned, in terms of politics, feminists and gender diverse folk and sexually diverse folk don't always see eye to eye. Alison and Alina, in as far as you feel comfortable, I'd love to talk about how welcome you've felt in spaces that call themselves feminist in your lifetimes. I would probably say that I'd probably say I've felt pretty welcome, and particularly today I feel very, very safe, so that's good. Alison?
Okay. I guess spaces like this that are quite open and welcoming are quite good. It's sort of when you get to the more groups who are very stringent about definitions. I think that can be quite exclusionary. Like, is that, yeah. Because, like, I'm non-binary, so... I mean, a lot of the time I'm sort of left out of discussion anyway, which, you know, is what it is. But I don't know, there's... Sometimes I feel like it's a conscious effort to exclude people like us. And then, but I do find most of the time everyone is pretty welcoming and sort of... If they don't realise they're being exclusionary, then you can be like, hey, have you thought about this? And then people are generally like, oh, right, cool, great. So, yeah, I think people are pretty flexible, which is nice.
Awesome. Yeah. Alina, do you want to add anything?
This is why I didn't go first. What I was going to say is my experience is that I came to Australia when I was about 3 years old, and I lived here till about 11, moved to Pakistan as what I thought as an Aussie kid, lived there till just before turning 20, and then came back to start university. And I went to Sydney Uni in 1997 for my first degree, and lots of things happened, and I was banned from the women's room. And one of the reasons I was banned from the women's room is because I didn't fit their idea of what a person of colour should be. I should be oppressed. I should have all these assumptions. This is in the 90s. And my family lived on the North Shore, and I grew up with every sort of opportunity available, made available to me. So I wasn't oppressed in my mind. I wasn't raised to believe I was oppressed. If we talked about education, which was really important in my family and in my world, my mother's mother went to university and was a practicing psychologist for many years before she married my granddad. So for me, then being told by the women in the women's space that I was this oppressed Pakistani woman, I really did not take kindly to that, and I felt that wasn't my space. So my space was the queer space.
It's interesting you mention getting kicked out of spaces at uni, because it's such a common, weirdly common experience. Like, I was sort of ostracized in no uncertain terms by the queer community at my uni when I started dating a boy. They were like, well, you're not queer enough for us, which would be fair if it was called the lesbian space, but it was called the queer space. And something to me felt pretty queer about going from girls to boys. I was like, check me out. This is, like, so diverse, right? Even though, yeah. So I guess the exclusionary side of things is something that I wanted to raise early on. And I want to talk about how things have changed. And, Alina, I guess I'll start with you. You mentioned that happened in the 90s. How are things now, do you reckon?
Well, I'm still going back to Sydney in his women's space. Still not going back there. Well, I can actually fast forward almost 10 years from then when I decided to go and do a master's at Monash. And it was a very different environment then. I came back as an older student, a mature age student. I already was working. And I decided I actually needed to study gender studies because I never had. Mm. And this was 2004 and a good 7 years later. And I had been in the 90s loving queer politics and queer theory and everything queer. And I did date boys and girls and both at the same time. And that was all right in the queer circle I was in.
Well, lucky you.
You had to come to Sydney.
My uni was in Sydney.
Wrong uni. But when I went to Monash Uni, it was really interesting, and I can't even remember the lecturer's name now, shame. But she was really good at challenging me on what I thought feminism was, because I would say again and again, I'm not a feminist, I'm not. And she would say, but you are. And we'd have this argument twice a week when I'd come to the university. And it took me actually finishing the degree and years later realising that actually I am, but it was the label of that word and my experience growing up that made me believe that I am not a feminist.
What was it about the word that put you off, do you think?
My mother never used it. My father never used it. No one used it growing up. So when I only ever heard it, it was on Australian radio and it meant hairy, man-hating lesbian. It was always a horrible, horrible word. And I didn't want to be a part of something that people mocked and hated. And so when I was fighting my sexuality and my spirituality, there was no way I was going to throw feminism into that as well. I was like, right, I've got enough struggles here. And my mum, who I think by every definition of the word feminist is a feminist and is an amazing feminist too, she wouldn't use that word to describe herself. And I had that conversation with her years later as to, you know, was it because of that man-hating, you know, stereotype, or was it that it just wasn't conscious? And it wasn't. For her, every woman needs to be questioning her state, her position in the world. Every woman must have every opportunity. Every woman must be who she is. And so for her, it was just her existence, which was being feminist without actually using the definition.
So it's interesting you talk about your identities, I guess the intersectionality of your many, many parts of your identity. And you didn't want to add this extra layer of feminism to that already complex sort of framework. Alison, and I guess Alina as well, I wanted to ask you both if you think that queer writing in itself, either sexually diverse or gender diverse, is inextricably feminist, and whether you can separate the two?
I don't know.
That's okay.
I think, I guess, yeah, it is, because I guess feminism is a radical act, and choosing to write about being queer is also a radical act, and I think they're sort of not the same thing, but they're very linked. They have a lot of the same principles, you know, like equality, diversity, just all that. Yeah, I don't know how to separate those issues. Like, they're not the same issues, but also they're very closely linked, I think. Yeah.
And do you see your writing as feminist writing all the time, or only when it's conscious?
I don't know. I guess it's all the time. Because I guess even subconsciously, you know, I'm sort of informed by the world around me and my ideals anyway. And so my writing comes from my experience, from me. And, yeah. Yeah.
Alina, what do you reckon?
Of course I'm going to say no. Look, for me, being in the uni in the 90s, identity politics was it. And it was all about... Gender was such an issue for me because all my life I have tried to be girl and I think I'm a girl, and I think I present as girl, but I am challenged because of my voice. I'm challenged because of how I dress. I'm challenged because how I present myself. And for years and years, I felt, again, that, well, the queer part of me allows me to play with the gender, but the feminist part of me won't, and therefore I don't see myself as when I write, as unless it's a specific feminist piece of writing, as that being feminist. I mean, I'm a queer Muslim woman, but if I write, and I'm writing in my cookbook, that's not feminist writing. That's not queer writing. That's just writing. And so for me, I think it's really important that my uneasy battle with feminism that I do believe I've solved now and I do believe that I've embraced, I still feel that it takes this world where, and this bit's going to be interesting how the audience reacts, it's becoming a mother is what actually made me go, right, I'm a feminist now. Thank you.
That was a reaction.
From another mother in the room too.
Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Look, because, I mean, the first thing is I couldn't carry, so my ex-partner, she did, and I had to deal with the death of my womb. And I took a whole year to get over this because I knew everyone would ask, whose kid is it? And it took me a very long time. I mean, I remember pushing Elliot down in the pram down Racecourse Road and some stranger going, oh, he's so cute. And I'd be like, thank you, my partner gave birth. Because my identity as mother, I challenged myself.
Yeah.
And then the day that I finally realised that Elliot adored me and he called me mama and he called my, you know, his other mum mummy, and he saw no difference between the two of us, and he doesn't, neither does his younger brother, that's the day I actually went, I'm going to be proud of looking how I do. I'm going to be proud. I'm going to call myself a feminist. I'm going to say I'm a mother. I'm the non-birth mother. I'm going to use all these words which I was ashamed of and afraid of. And that's actually when I went, right, I'm a feminist now.
Yeah, so much of responding to feminist writing is more about defining your own positions. And I think increasingly I've been thinking about the, or noticing the loud sort of internalized queerphobic, homophobic, misogynistic voice that most of us probably have. And for me, feminist writing is trying to debunk that by saying that other people have it. But I've decided I'm going to start, maybe make like a line of badges for same-sex mothers that just says, just say congratulations. Because yeah. It's always with the fucking questions,
yes.
Isn't it? Just
questions.
So boring. When it comes to whether queer writing is inextricably linked with feminism, I wanted to weigh in from my perspective. Part of me thinks it is, and my example of that is the story in the recent issue of Archer magazine, which is about menstrual sex, and it is completely right. It's completely focused on queer women's perspectives because the writer happens to be a queer woman. But in itself, the fact that it appears in a magazine with photos of menstrual blood, the photo is amazing. It's this woman lying topless with like a really sublime look on her face, and she's got blood all over her fingers, and you just know what she's been doing. The fact that that is in print and speaks so intimately about details of feminine bodies is extremely feminist. It just happens to be queer writing. But then conversely, there are arguments a lot of the time in the queer community that talk about how gay men particularly don't engage with feminism as much as they should, and there are pockets of the queer community that seem to forget about feminist ideals because they're caught up with queer ideals. So I do think it's something that people need to be conscious of, as well as rather than taking for granted that it's inextricably linked. Would you agree, either of you?
I don't know, but when you said the menstrual blood thing, I shudder. I do. That's the stuff that freaks me out, and that's the stuff at uni that I felt really uncomfortable around. Rad femmes, they hated me because I would challenge them and I would say, no, there's nothing great about whatever they would say is great. And I wouldn't see their point. I remove all body hair, and I do that part culturally because that's how I've been raised, but I like it. And when I'm furry, doesn't matter whether it's my legs or even my forearms, I don't like the feel. I don't. And We can all argue and say that's because I've been socialized into believing that body hair is bad, da da da, but I just don't like the feel of it.
I think that's fair. And, you know, my wife and I have a very heteronormative relationship, and, you know, I'm cool with that. That's perfectly socialized, but we do that, and it's radical because we're both women. She does the heavy lifting. Do you think that we're moving towards a time in feminism where it's more about identifying individual preferences and respecting them?
I can see that definitely in queer world. I mean, my ex and I are the same age, which means we'll be 40 next year. Yes, I know, I don't look it. Lucky me. But my school kids think I do. But we met in our 20s. And so we used to, when we met and we'd go out to clubs and that was the world we were in, and then we got too old for those clubs and had dinner parties. And we used to get very frustrated that the queer kids that we'd see out looked very different to us, because we came from the world where you had to wear, you know, Docs and Bonds t-shirts, because those signifiers were so important walking down the street. They were so important as not just your identity, but just making sure, hey, yes, we're all part of the same family. And that's gone now in queer world. That's completely gone. And I initially resisted that because I thought, no, we've battled to have this uniform and we've battled to be proud of who we are. And we're showing the world by wearing those Bonds t-shirts and Doc Martens. But we don't need to do that battle anymore. And I think it's the same thing with feminism. I see young girls in my class take on boys in my class, and it's not because they're battling them. It's because they just go, well, what's your issue? They'll just argue it back without even thinking that they're doing anything. And I watch the arguments happen, and it's amazing because these girls don't know that they're the future feminists.
Alison, you're the co-editor of Concrete Queers, which is a zine that curates works from people who identify as queer, correct? So tell us a bit about the community that's gathered around that publication, like in terms of their, I guess, gender politics and how feminism fits in with that.
Well, I guess we sort of... I found that in the zine community, I think particularly a lot of people who are in like the minorities sort of come together, like, you know, asexual people, trans people, just people like that. They sort of, like, I remember we launched our first issue at a zine fair, and this girl came up and she was like, oh, are ace people allowed to publish with you? And I was like, yes. Of course. And it sort of just...
Ace is short for asexual.
Oh, yes, sorry. and so I guess it's more... Because we're very small, so... Yeah, I guess we're a tiny community, but I think we're pretty diverse, and it's just nice to not... Because our submitters don't have to... It's not like... If you're bi, you have to write about bi stuff. It's just you can sort of write about whatever. It's just a place where if you're queer, you can submit stuff and, you know, we'll read it. And I guess it's kind of freeing in a way to just sort of let people speak and to give a tiny platform to those voices, but a platform, which I think is quite nice.
I think sometimes writers appreciate the size of the diminutive size of the platform as well. Like,
yeah.
I had a pitch from a writer this week actually that I was like, you should pitch this to The Guardian. Why are you sending it to Archer? And the writer was like, I don't want it to get out that much.
Yeah.
And I was like, thanks. But it does keep it at a sort of community level, and to a point, you know that your audience is going to be majority people that see eye to eye with you, and there's a safety in that.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, because like we're in Sticky Institute, which is in DeGrave Street. It's very cool. It's a zine shop. Go there. And we're just on Etsy and Beer Cartel. And so, yeah, I guess the audience is very curated, and I think that's also, like, I feel like people feel safe publishing with us.
Yeah.
That's what I really love about it.
Yeah, it reminds me in the last panel, the panelists were talking about whether preaching to the converted is a thing, And I think it was established that it was not a thing or not a bad thing, because it means that we get space to talk about issues that are important to us in, with people that aren't going to attack us for them, which, well, hopefully. And I guess there's been huge discussions about calling out culture of late, and I see it everywhere. I've become a reader of just comments instead of actual articles. No, not bad comments, like the comments on my friends' Facebook feeds. So I'll see a headline on my Facebook feed and then read all what my friends have to say about it just to keep up with their politics and what that issue means to them, because I feel I have to and that's my duty. But gee, call out, whoa, big, scary. I don't feel that in Concrete Queers or in Archer magazine there would be that level of calling out. And Alina, similarly, Queer Muslims in Australia was an online support group that you set up, which has been beneficial for lots of people. So I guess as writers and as feminists and as queers on this stage at least, the importance of community is something we can all relate to in a big way. How's being a queer writer for you?
99 times out of 100, it's my story of being a queer Muslim woman that is of what's of interest. So it
pretty
is
interesting.
Not for the person who has to write it again but then change it because they're having to write it for a different audience. Mm. So, but yeah, look, I understand that why there's an interest. And I set this group up way back in 2004 when, yes, it's a Yahoo group. That's how long ago it is. And I'm not changing it. And look, I set this group up because I have a family that support my sexuality. I have a family who embrace my children. I have a family where I haven't had those horror stories where, get out, you're no longer part of our family. So for me, it was like, well, if I'm lucky enough to be queer and Muslim, then I need to help others. The frustrating thing is for years and years, I have been the only person willing to be open about it. So the one who does the newspaper stuff and the TV stuff.
Yeah, you were on the telly. I saw it on YouTube. It's really cool.
Yeah, no, I don't like that. I look fat. Is that a feminist thing to say?
You're allowed, but that's the telly for you. Like, it's really shocking seeing yourself on telly.
Yeah, no, bad hair. I know what you're But for me, I get that. But there are more people who are coming up now, and I think that's great. So every time there is someone else who is a queer Muslim voice that speaks, people say to me, oh, how do you feel about that? I'm like, I'm so glad. I am not the only queer Muslim in Australia. Like, mind you, in 2004, I felt like that. I really did. Mm. I didn't know anyone, not a single person, you know, and that's changed big time since then. But it's interesting because, yes, that it is very much the identity politics. People want to know about my life as a queer Muslim woman. I mean, the last thing I wrote for the ABC sexuality website was about queers of colour and talking about Orlando. And I did... was still asked to put the queer Muslim thing in there too. Still only put a couple of lines in there. But for me, I was like, I want to talk about something that's just as important as being a queer Muslim woman, but I am not specifically talking about queer Muslims in this context. At that point, we didn't know about the assailant. We didn't know anything about him at that point when I was asked to write it. So from my point of view, I was just focusing on the horror of that place and the targeting and the location. And for me, I thought that, right, I will write as someone who has gone to clubs and gone up to a girl and thought, hey, I've got a chance here. And the girl's gone, sorry, I don't do libs. And I've gone, I'm not Lebanese. And then gone, what's wrong with Lebanese people anyway? So I get discriminated against for an ethnicity that I'm not actually a part of.
So, yeah, that's an interesting one when you get asked to write from a queer perspective on a topic that actually has nothing to do with you. I'm not saying that in that sense, but I was asked to write on Orlando for Daily Life as well, and I was like, shit, like, what am I going to say about that? And what I ended up saying, which could be called a cop-out, but I thought was socially responsible, was like, we need to listen to other people in this time. How do you two feel about being asked to represent... I guess, queer writing, and also how do we nurture those voices and that importance of the writing community in terms of queer politics?
In my case, any time I'm asked, I always forward it to the group, and there is about 150 people in that community based all over Australia, and I say, does someone want to speak at this event? Does someone want to respond to this? Does someone else want to... You can be anonymous. You do not have to provide any other details. You can use my name, but does someone else want to do it? I always ask to try and get other people to do it.
That's so cool. I'm inspired.
I'm pretty new, so I haven't been asked to write anything. But I guess whenever I do write about stuff, particularly gender stuff, I always say this is only my opinion. Like, genderqueer means 100 million different things to 100 million different people, and it's just me. And I think, like, if I was asked to write about trans issues or, you know, something like that, I would probably say no and ask someone, you know, like, because trans women are so often excluded from the conversation. I'm like, why don't you ask, you know, this person or, yeah, I guess because I am quite privileged in the trans community because I am white and thin and kind of androgynous looking and assigned female at birth. And so, like, people love listening to me because I'm the easy option, I guess.
Yeah, I have a trans friend that refers to herself as trans light because she's because people can handle her.
People like, because I look like a girl, so, you know, it's a feminist. And so I guess, yeah, I guess always just trying to be conscious of my own privilege and how I can use that to help other people.
So we'll throw to the audience for questions in like 5 minutes. But before we do, staying with you, Alison, I wanted to know, identifying as genderqueer or non-binary sort of turns your back on this social construct of gender, obviously, and that's something that's becoming a lot more widespread. Do you see feminism as a binary concept? And if so, is that like difficult for you to navigate?
Yes. I guess because a lot of feminism doesn't like a lot of trans people, I don't really call myself a feminist. Like, if someone calls me a feminist, I'm like, yeah, cool, whatever. But I guess because it does exclude so many of my siblings, it's uneasy sometimes because, like my partner is assigned male at birth and they're Zize gender and... Like, Z doesn't at all feel welcomed by feminism because no one talks about people like them often. And so it's tricky, I guess. I've forgotten the original question.
The answer was it's tricky.
Okay,
yeah, it is tricky. I think I agree. And I guess the word feminism is loaded with its history, which... is something that we all probably think about a lot as feminists. I see feminism as being as sticking up for myself, and that's about it, in which case I think we would all agree that that's a lens we want to look through. But once you bring that word in, it suddenly becomes quite loaded for a lot of people. Any audience questions?
Hi, this is for all of you. I'm a cisgender woman in a heterosexual relationship, although I consider myself queer, and I want to be a writer. And I've started writing a book, and it involves a character that is trans, and I wondered how you guys feel about, do I have any right to write that character? And if not, do I always have to write cis white female characters?
Okay. I think you always have to be, like, aware of your own position, I guess, because, like, I'm really sick of reading cis characters. I don't really want to read anymore. So I think you sort of have to, I don't know who your friends are or whatever, but, like, talk to trans people. Just know that, like, because I find a lot of trans characters written by cis people, it's like, oh no, I am trans, I must transition. I have transitioned, everything is perfect now, my life is so great. And because, like, when, like, trans people aren't just trans people, they're just people. And, like, we don't spend every single second of every day thinking about gender and... I mean, I spend a lot of time thinking about it, but not, it's not, like, my main hobby. So I guess, I don't know, you just have to be careful. Make sure you're not accidentally being, like, super offensive. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Yeah. So
it is okay?
I think it's okay.
I guess it's also about the queer question as well, because I'm also in, you know, that heterosexual relationship and my characters are both queer, and I don't know if I have the right to do that either, so I don't know if that would apply to you guys more, how you feel about that.
Well, I was just going to relate it to my experience. I'm going to do a plug for the book now. I've got a chapter in one of the books that's been sold here, Growing Up Muslim in Australia, Coming of Age, Growing Up Muslim. And I and a couple of the authors in the book were asked by the publisher to review a Australian woman's story of a, it's just come out the book, a Western Sydney suburb school in which there's a Pakistani girl and a Lebanese girl and... can't remember the third ethnicity. And I was asked to look at it from a point of view as a Pakistani woman, had the author, who'd been to Pakistan herself, I think, and had taught Pakistani girls forever, had she been authentic? That's what I was asked. And that's exactly what I did. I went through it with a fine-tooth comb. Couldn't comment on the Lebanese girl or the... and I can't remember the third one. But the Pakistani girl and the Pakistani family, who were the main protagonists of the story... I was very much aware, and I'd say things like, and when I, and this is part lawyer, part teacher in me, my God, I made a lot of edits. And when I went through it, I'd say things like, well, why is she saying this particular phrase? We only use that, you know, when we're celebrating, but she's using it when, you know, just on an ordinary day. Like, they were the questions I had, but I didn't have a problem that the woman who was writing it was a white woman teaching in the western suburbs, because her lived experience might not have been for her as a Pakistani girl, but she was immersed in that culture and immersed in that world, so much so that she felt confident enough to write about it. And what the publishers did, which is, of course, to check the authenticity, they had a bunch of different Muslim writers check it. The interesting thing is one of my co-authors, he said, I was asked to do this, but I think it's ridiculous. What would I know about being a Pakistani girl when I'm a Pakistani male? And he said that, and I wrote up on his Facebook feed right away. I commented. And other people had first started attacking the publisher for asking him and another man in the book. And when I wrote, no, I did, and then everyone, oh, okay, it's all right. Pakistani girl, check the book. The world is safe now. We're good now. So I think the roundabout way of me saying that if you can, and completely agrees with what you said, is if you can check the authenticity, if you run it past people, and no one gets anything published till you have like about 20 people read it anyway. So once you get that read and you're challenged on it and you change things, I think that's probably the best way to go.
I just wanted to say that sounds awesome and good on you for writing in the first place. And also that, like, I totally get what you're saying about being in a heterosexual relationship. And I often say probably more to my mates than, like, roomfuls of strangers, but there we are, that if I'd ended up with a bloke instead of a woman, then I probably wouldn't have started Archer because I would have felt too self-conscious about my... And, like, what a shame. That would suck. And I think... everyone's got a different kind of idea of what the word queer means. And I came up with a new definition, probably like the 50th for myself, which was that it means that you don't identify with the kind of sexual identities that you see in the mainstream media. And that kind of could relate to anybody and is empowering and good and a great thing. And I think that it just because you... define your relationship status at the moment by the word heterosexual doesn't mean that you're not queer and you don't have a voice. And also more queer voices, if you can, particularly if you can bring in trans people to advise you on your story. That's awesome. Yeah. We've got time for one more question.
Hey, you all touched on call-out culture, which I was really glad for because it's been something that I've been talking a lot about within my group of predominantly queer friends. And we have a general stance that we prefer to call people in rather than call people out. And I kind of get the impression that that might be the case for you three as well. And my question is, if that is the case, what's your best piece of advice for kind of having a meaningful dialogue with somebody that has conflicting views to yours? And do you have any heartening examples of perhaps getting through to somebody and seeing a change?
Calling in is a very cool term. Thank you for that's very cool. I don't know if I have any heartening examples, really. Because the only one that's coming to mind is a person I used to know on Twitter was really transphobic, and I was like, hey, can you maybe say this instead? Because that's really bad. And then he was like, no, you're transphobic. And I was like, oh, okay. So I guess calling in doesn't really work all of the time, but I think it's sort of definitely a better approach than being like, oh, you're not a feminist, you should die. So I don't know, do you have any examples? Because my mind is so blank.
I might be going off in a bit here, but I work in Melton, and apologies to anyone who works in Melton, but Melton is a very, very rough suburb, and I teach there, primary school. And I'm not out to most staff about my faith, but I am about my sexuality. So everyone knows I'm queer, but they don't know I'm Muslim, because we're talking Reclaim Australia protests and things like that happen, and I hear the most nasty Islamophobic things amongst the aides, not necessarily the teacher class, but yeah, the integration aides, the support staff. And I've heard them, and I'm too wuss to say anything because I need these people to help me with my severe behaviour kids in my class. So I zip it and say nothing. But I look this way, I teach grade 5-6, and I have girls who have started saying to, and I know parents look at me and go, but I'm not out to any parents whatsoever. And my girls have started saying to other girls that, you know, we should get our hair cut short, like, you know, like Miss M's hair. We should get our hair cut short. And I've had boys even say, and, you know, that you're, again, like, you know, Miss, it's really great that you can play with us boys, but you're still a girl. That's the way grade 6 boys compliment you. And the grade 6 girls themselves, they see that, and they say, I had girls say to me, Miss, well, how come you never wear a skirt to school or you don't wear a dress? And I go, because you don't want to see my legs, they're so muscly that you'll get so jealous and die. I've actually said that to my grade 6 girls. I mean, not appropriate. And I've actually had girls now, and this is a really subtle, but no one in my class wears a dress. I'm the only grade 5-6 class where all the girls wear shorts or tracksuit pants. And it's been this subtle little overtaking that I've done in which they're all being, well, they're queering themselves, I say. Or their dress, at least, because they see someone they see as a role model being comfortable in wearing, you know, I've come straight from work now, wearing Vans and jeans to work, and they think, oh, maybe I can dress like this and still be girl.
That's so cool. I'll just give a last thought on that question, which was a great question. I guess that I mentioned earlier that I'm non-confrontational because I get scared, frankly. Look, it's a long story and I won't go into it, but basically my Archer team got pretty horribly trolled at the start of this week by a particularly obnoxious right-wing blogger. And my response was to call them all up individually and let them know and then promptly go to bed and cry for 3 days. And each of their responses were like, amazing and so heartening, and they were each like, yeah, good, means we're doing great stuff or whatever. Like, they were so robust and impressive, and I was like, I love my team. But I did literally cry for a couple of days. And I guess my main piece of advice with calling in, as you so astutely put it, is that you need to know your own limitations. And in a world where, like, feminist writing is kind of almost defined by the likes of Clem Ford and Amy Gray and these fierce, and Jax Brown, these fierce feminist writers that put themselves out there time and time and time again, they also have really strong awareness of themselves and their own limitations and their boundaries and their own self-care, models of self-care. And it took me like 5 years to find my model of self-care, and I'm still honing it. But I guess the point of this ramble is to say that we're not always capable every single day of fighting every battle, and it's good to look after ourselves as well, because otherwise you just burn out and you can't fight anything. Cool. Thank you. I'll hand over to you, Ronnie.
Thanks to all three of you. That's such a beautiful way to thank you to all of you for coming along to the inaugural networking day for the Feminist Writers Festival. We're hoping that there will be more to come in future years. I just want to say a few very quick thank yous. So we really want to thank the Melbourne Writers Festival, who basically brought us under their wing and enabled us to actually start this festival. The Queen Vic Women's Centre for being such a beautiful space. All the incredible volunteers, this is an entirely volunteer-run festival, which is pretty mind-blowing. Thanks all. Our interstate and non-urban speakers today, who brought themselves here, we're incredibly grateful for their presence. We will also be sending out feedback surveys over the weekend so that we can find out more about your experience today and how we can improve for the future. And we'd really appreciate it if you could fill those out, because we're learning so much from this experience. And as an incentive, we've also got a feminist book pack, which one person who fills it out will win. So make sure you do so. So this is our last session, and we need to be out by 5:30. Please exit as quickly as you can. Once again, thanks all of you so much for coming.
This has been a special broadcast from Broad at the Melbourne Feminist Writers Festival on Joy 94.9.
Bombastic, bodacious, revolutionary, rash, outraged, organized, assertive, activist, day,
Broad
on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.